ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, Selena Green here for a packed Country Hour for you today. Plenty of happening for us to cover in just a sec to an issue that's festering on the state's west coast, where oyster farmers have demanded answers from the government over the movement of oysters from an area that's impacted by the algae bloom to an area that's not.
The entire west coast, in essence, 80% of the state's oyster farming is still open and unaffected. So our concern really was around the risk posed by transferring oysters that have been sitting in impacted water to clean water.
That's coming up. And you may have heard the government's floating a possible lowering of speed limits on unsigned posted country roads, but some worry that that'll be just an excuse to spend less on fixing up regional roads.
The sealed roads that we have, some of them are not in amazing condition, much less the unsealed roads. I mean, if they reduce the speed limit, we'd be a little bit worried that it might be an excuse to lower the already tight budget for maintaining and upgrading the roads around here.
That's to come, and you might have some thoughts on that. You can share them on 1300 160 222 or send me a text on 0467 922 783. But yes, as we reported yesterday, an angry group of oyster farmers and other West Coast locals formed a blockade at Haslam near Streaky Bay to prevent oysters going into the water from Franklin Harbour. Now, they say they were caught by surprise by PIRS's decision to allow the movement of the oysters from a bay that's currently closed due to the algae bloom to the west coast, an area unaffected by the bloom. The SA Oyster Growers Association said it was blindsided with the decision. It met yesterday with PIRSA, with the Minister Claire Scriven and Sardi. And Brooke Neindorf caught up with the chair of the Oyster Association, Peter Trelaw, to find out what was discussed.
We received the scientific evidence for the government making their decision to approve the application to relocate. We actually asked that the minister reconsider this approval, which she said she wasn't prepared to do. So the approval stands. And look, the concern really is coming to us from growers on our west coast who don't really want to be put at any risk whatsoever. The government is saying to us that the risk is minimal. That may well be so, but a minimal risk is some risk, and we don't want to spread the bloom unnecessarily.
That scientific research that they've put forward today is, you know, the growers have been calling for scientific-based facts why this was going ahead. Is that enough to prove that it's okay to be putting it in there, or is it, you know, is there still concerns? As you said, it's still a low risk is still a risk.
Yeah, a low risk is still a risk. So some weeks ago now, SASQAP and SAOGA between us commissioned a report by a private consultant into this. Now, he's done a power of work. My understanding is that that report is nearly complete, but not quite, due by the end of this week. So we would have preferred, honestly, for the government to just hold off on this approval until that paper came through.
There's been talk that there hasn't been enough consultation. Has there been consultation? PIRSA have said they've been speaking with the association, but you know, has there been enough?
Look, honestly, we were blindsided by this decision. So we discovered yesterday afternoon that this approval had come forward. We were aware that an application was in, but we had no consultation or heads up with our association, which left us a bit blindsided. And honestly, our phones have been running hot with concerns from growers. We're a peak body. We represent the vast majority of South Australian oyster growers who are members, and we need to take their thoughts on count. And the majority, especially on the West Coast, are pretty upset and concerned at the moment.
What about the growers that have been shut for many months now around Stansbury and Franklin Harbour? How are they feeling, the ones that can't move their oysters, about these ones that can be moved?
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. I guess they're in a situation where They can't do much at all. Theoretically, they could make an application now to move oysters, couldn't they? And it would be considered in a case-by-case scenario by PIRRSA and the government. Those guys, well, especially on the around the York Peninsula, they've been shut since end of April, early May. So it's really been a long time, as you know, and they're suffering as businesses and communities probably. And I think the other point I'd like to make about the West Coast is that, of course, there are other industries involved as well. There's an abalone industry. It's home to the Northern Zone rock lobster. So potentially, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but the potential is always there for the harmful algal bloom and associated brevetoxin to be spread. And we just don't want to see that happen. We believe it's too much of a risk.
Can the association or growers do anything more from here? We've obviously seen today the protest at the Haslam boat ramp and growers parking their cars there to try and stop oysters from going into the water. But, you know, is there anything that you look at doing now?
Well, I think meeting with the minister who gives the final tick off of approval for these transfers, that's as much as we can do in a short term notice. We appreciated the opportunity to speak with the minister, and she took on board our concerns. I think what we'd like to see going forward, you know, this has happened now. The minister's not prepared to revoke the approval, but what we desperately need to see is better communication with us as a peak body from PIRRSA and the government. It's been pretty good for the most part during this last 6 or 8 months, but for a peak body to be caught blindsided, we don't believe is acceptable.
Can they guarantee that, you know, it's going to be safe to put those oysters in the water?
Well, they can't guarantee that. No, they can't. As we've been saying, the risk, according to the government, is negligible, and I accept that, but they can't say there's no risk whatsoever. So we just don't believe it's a risk worth taking.
Chair of the SA Oyster Growers Association, Peter Treloar. James Boylan is an oyster grower at Smoky Bay and was at the Haslam boat ramp yesterday and is heading there again this afternoon. He says he still can't believe that they're willing to take the risk.
The blockade was put in place to prevent the oysters from entering our waterways. One boat did enter the waterways and they retracted it and took the oysters back out. And as we speak, there's 3 barges of oysters sitting in their shed at Haslam with the ramp blocked.
What happens if the oysters are just sitting there?
Well, at the end of the day, the oysters will have to be returned back to Franklin Harbour.
So
but that's yet to be negotiated. The politicians are trying to work their way through stuff, and we'll see where this lands.
What point are you at the moment as an oyster grower? You've been speaking to a lot of people the last sort of 24 to 36 hours. Where have you got to now?
It's easy to be a general after the war, I suppose, but the blame game and that is I'm not into that, but the logic of trying to make this decision when you compare 20 tonnes of oysters from a bloom-closed bay into the pristine waterways of the West Coast with no consultation with anybody but themselves, the compared to what's to lose is all the communities up and down this coast, all the fishing industries, other than the oyster industries, there's all the other fishing industries that are in the ocean, the businesses, the tourism. Is this worth 20 tonnes of blue oysters? And the best they can come up with, it's a low to moderate risk. Well, any risk and what's at stake shouldn't even be considered. It should be a no-brainer. It should not ever be allowed. I've got good mates from Stansbury and Franklin Harbour. We're one big family, the oyster family. But this is bigger than just the oyster family. This is the wider communities that get affected here as well. So don't take your eyes off that. But I feel for them. I know them. They're some of my best mates. And I talk to them regularly. So I know where they're coming from. But on the same token, they've got it that they don't want to bring anyone else down either. And it's just an act of God of what's happened to them but they are considerate and thinking of others and would never do this to another oyster grower. But somehow it seems that it's lobbed over here, and you sort the rest out for yourselves.
That's Smoky Bay oyster grower James Boylan there, airing his frustrations with Brook Nindorf. And I'm told the blockade at Haslam is still underway. Now, PIRZA says it's conducted an independent risk assessment and got advice from algal bloom experts, deeming the risk of the relocated oysters generating a bloom to be low. And Professor Mike Steer is the executive director of SARDI. He spoke with Tom Mann about how the decision to move these oysters was made.
PIRZA, well, they approved, so that's the Department of Primary Industries and Regions, approved an application to move oysters from Franklin Harbour to Haslam through a thorough risk assessment. The department worked closely with the South Australian Oyster Growers Association, who represents the majority of oyster growers in SA, and after they advised that they could not come to a consensus on whether that would happen. And then based on an independent risk assessment and thorough analysis that really drew on the advice from algal bloom experts and oyster aquaculture regulators from the US, New Zealand, Tasmania, New South Wales, the risk of the relocated oysters generated in a bloom was deemed to be low. So then the applicant at Haslam's was the only oyster operator there and would have to remain in a quarantine area until testing shows a reduction in the brevi toxins. So, moving and relaying oysters is something that's a normal part of the oyster growing operation that occurs quite regularly. In fact, it's occurred three times before during this bloom. You know, once in early May from Stansbury to Coffin Bay, when the crinia counts were relatively high. And again, from Franklin Harbour to Haslam's in July, and Franklin Harbour to Coffin Bay in July also. So in those three occasions, the oysters had been relayed or moved without any treatment, and which didn't have an impact on that area. But this particular movement too, there's a few suggested conditions that will reduce the risk further mitigate it, and that's, you know, to keep your oysters out drying for 24 hours, rinse them, just to ensure that, and don't transfer any of the equipment with it to ensure that there is, no carinia transfer.
Now, of course, some of the oyster operators in the region are concerned of any risk, but, you know, when you say there was a risk assessment done and it was deemed low, what is the chance that this could cause spread? Is there a number figure you could put on it?
Oh, well, the biology tells us a lot, because the particular species that we're interested in, you know, was a group of species in a family called Carinia. You might remember we were referring to it as Carinia micimotoi, but there's another number of other species. They're incredibly delicate. Despite them being persistent in the environment, you know, our scientists are trying to actively culture them in the laboratory to get a better understanding of them, and they are just absolutely struggling to collect them from the wild and bring them in to the lab. So they don't travel well at all. They're incredibly delicate, and we see that through the foaming too of the beaches along the metropolitan coast. They just break up so easily. So any sort of movement, agitation, fresh water tends to knock them over really quickly. So the risk, from a biological perspective, is negligible.
You know, is there a plan for if the bloom is spread by this move?
Well, we're routinely checking water quality, and so there'll be active surveillance. But Carinia is present at low levels anyway. So, you know, if we were to go and test the waters, you do see at times of the year, low levels of Carinia. So it's not like they're being they're being introduced or the need to eradicate them. They're always there in relatively low numbers. So what we have been finding too is if you followed the release yesterday of the information, is we're starting to see declines in some of the concentrations of Carinia. There's early signs that, although we're putting a lid on it at the moment, there's early signs that it seems like the bloom, may be waning. So it looks like we're heading into conditions that wouldn't be particularly under the West Coast that are unlikely to be favourable for any growth.
And will there be, though, increased testing, or what will be the level of testing for these waters?
Yeah, there's testing that happens weekly there regardless along the West Coast. In fact, there's testing along most of the sites, most of the coast of South Australia weekly. So not only are we testing the water for the plankton, but the South Australian Shellfish Quality Assurance Program also tests the oysters regularly to maintain, I guess, an active surveillance over the biotoxin levels. And the particular biotoxin that we're interested in at the moment associated with the Karenia is the brevitoxin. So they are routinely sampled weekly. And it's not until those levels drop below, I think it's 0.8 milligrams per kilogram for a couple of weeks, then they can reopen for human consumption.
Now, there has been, from PRRSA, they've mentioned that there was consultation with the industry, but clearly they were taken by surprise and, a blockade formed at Haslam yesterday. What did you make of this impromptu blockade?
Oh, look, that was surprising to me, but, that's the right of the community. But in terms of the regulatory process, there's a relay application process that can be undertaken, and the regulators will assess them on a case by case basis. So in this particular situation, this case was assessed on the basis of the movement from A to B, the conditions, and the scientific evidence that was done through an independent assessment and a PRRSA assessment. And the decision was made on that basis. That doesn't mean that other relay requests that come through will have the same level of approval. They'll still have to go through that rigorous case by case assessment.
Professor Mike Steer, the Executive Director at SARDI, speaking with Tom Mann. It's 22 minutes past 12.
You're listening to the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're with Selena Green on the Country Hour today. Well, you may have heard that the federal government's proposing to reduce the default speed limit on unsigned roads outside of built-up areas. Now, the proposal suggests lowering speed limits on both dirt and unsealed roads, as well as gravel and sealed roads, to a range of speed limits between 90 k's an hour and 70 k's an hour, depending on the road condition. Road safety groups support the measure as road deaths rise, but those opposing it say it's a lazy alternative to repairing poor country roads. Among those are the Pastoralists Association of West Darling, and President Sam Bevan says he's worried that it will mean less road funding and it has a potential impact on those trucking livestock.
The sealed roads that we have, some of them are not in amazing condition, much less the unsealed roads. I mean, if they reduce the speed limit, we'd be a little bit worried that it might be an excuse to lower the budget, lower the already tight budget for maintaining and upgrading the roads around here. They might be more inclined to say, oh, well, the speed limit's lower now, so there's no need to seal that dirt road, or there's no need to make a few little roads wider or fix that causeway or whatever the case may be.
How big of an issue is roads and the quality of roads here in the Far West?
POWD is always lobbying with the government to maintain and reseal a lot of roads. I mean, if it weren't for POWD, it's possible there'd still be a dirt road all the way from Stevens Creek to Warrigate. Yeah, it's very important to us that the roads keep getting maintained and upgraded. It quite often there's a rain event that, there might be a shoulder of a corner gone, or any damage could happen like that. And we like to hope that the budget, if anything, just keeps sneaking upwards rather than getting any tighter than it already is, because every time we ask for anything, we quite often hear that it's not in the budget, or they can't afford it this year, or something along those lines.
Of pastoralists, they do travel long distances here in the Far West, and so reducing the speed limit mean in terms of the travel time someone might take, or just the decisions that they might now then make?
Our major concern would be the livestock trucks. I mean, we're already a long way from all of our sale yards, abattoirs, processes and what have you, and there's a curfew on most of these places if we suddenly... And we're already tight on the curfew. A lot of the trucks are already turning up there quite late. And if we had to yeah, we'd have to be loading at a different time, or even the trucks might have to travel with two people driving just so that they don't run out of driving hours, because if they run out of their work hours, they have to stop for 6 or 7 hours, and that's just an animal welfare issue in itself, the longer travel times there. And if they end up driving two up in the truck, then freight gets more expensive, and you know, freight companies might not be able to find two people at a time to drive in the truck. It just make transporting livestock incredibly difficult. And that's just from a production point of view. I mean, just simple things like with School of the Air, going to mini schools or going to town weeks, if suddenly a 2 hour trip became a 2 hour and 45 minute trip or a 3 hour trip, it would make it sort of, people would be less inclined to go, even on the social side of things as well.
And just you mentioned abattoirs and things like that. Where do trucks go here in the region, just to articulate that?
An abattoir in, well, the closest one's in Mildura, which is recently open. Yeah, it isn't too far. But then there's Melbourne, there's Tamworth, Lobethal, Bourke. Some of our sheep go all the way to Gundagai. And Gundagai is already a fairly long stretch for us. It's roughly 1,000 kilometres. Yeah, that would make things a little bit difficult. Well, there's one in Charleville. I'm not sure how many people go that far, but they're sort of few and far between. So if they're, you know, without opening an abattoir in Broken Hill, for example, it would affect us greatly.
Yeah, so a massive kind of flow-on effect a decision like this would have on production and how businesses and pastoralists would operate.
Yeah, I feel like it would extend a great deal into the industry of livestock freight, or just regular freight. Anyone with a business that delves into trucks would think upon it very negatively, I would think.
That's the president of the Pastoralists Association of West Darling, Sam Bevan, speaking with Catherine Spackman. Now, public consultation on this proposal closes the 10th of November. As I mentioned, we have heard previously from road safety advocacy groups that are in support of the measure. Our Federal Regional Development Minister, Christy McBain, who's responsible for road safety, has told the ABC there were no speed limits on unsealed roads and encouraged interest stakeholders to engage in the consultation process. And she said the government had doubled funding for the Roads to Recovery program to $1 billion and would remain at high levels in future budgets. A couple of texts that have come through on this one. This one is from David in Coonawarra. He says, "Hi, Selena. In Tasmania, the maximum listed speed on dirt roads is 80 k's now. Our roads at Coonawarra skirt around huge gum trees and people do up to 110 on these roads." He says, "Not only is this speed dangerous, it wrecks the road in no time. I think it's a great move to reduce dirt road speeds. Also, they need to lower the towing speed of caravans and trailers. They should be the same as WA, which is 100 k's an hour," says David. This text, I'm about to read the same one there. Hang on. This one's from George at Wakery. "Hi, George." He says, "The country and rural communities produce the food and fibre for the vast population which lives in the city, who drive on bitumen roads and find it inconvenient to seek a doctor in a neighbouring suburb, have to travel 30 k's to see a specialist or take their kids 5 k's to school." He says, "Meanwhile, we in the country rural areas just simply bear the burden for the city," says George. Keep your thoughts coming through, though. It is 28 minutes past 12, so we better get to the Weather Bureau, and Daniel Sherwin-Simpson is our forecaster today. Hi, Daniel.
Good afternoon, Selena.
What's the main story with the weather today?
Yeah, look, we did see some storms roll through overnight yesterday, and also a little bit in the southeast this morning. We've generally seen that clear up. There could still be a little spot of a shower about, but most of it's rolled through. Totals wise, haven't seen too much. The highest was down at Padthaway South. They've got 12.6 in the last 24 hours. Edithburgh on the York Peninsula also picked up 10. As we move into the next few days, we're going to see a bit more sun, particularly tomorrow, as temperatures will start to warm up again ahead of a front approaching in the west. If you're in the far west tomorrow, sort of out more west than Sejuna, you might start to see some showers creeping in the afternoon, possibly making it to the Eyre Peninsula by the late evening. There could be a couple of storms about with that, particularly up in the far northwest of the state. They could get a bit gusty at times, possibly bringing some damaging winds. As this front rolls through broader parts of the state on Sunday, that's when we're going to see the rainfall from it become a bit more widespread. We'll generally see some decent showers sweep across large parts of the state through to Sunday and also in the east on the Monday. Once we get into Tuesday, things do get a little bit uncertain. We're expecting to see a low pressure system spin up sort of around Victoria and New South Wales area. And depending on how far west that actually goes, if it sort of moves over the SA border, border. We could get some decent rainfall in the eastern parts of the state on that Tuesday, but if it stays a little bit more towards the Victoria side of the country, we're probably not going to get as much rainfall out of it, so it's a bit of a watch this space with that. But generally speaking, in terms of the rainfall out to the end of Tuesday, we're looking at less than 2 millimetres over the far pastorals, ranging up to 2 to 10 over the agricultural areas, but possibly reaching 15 to 30 millimetres across the southeast and Mount Lofty ranges. If you see some thunderstorms with this front rolling through, you will obviously get a bit more rainfall, possibly in the 10 to 30 millimetre range. But if you're down in that southeast part of the state where it's going to be a bit wetter anyway, and you see some thunderstorms, you may even be able to see up to 40 or 45 millimetres by the end of Tuesday. Thank you, Selena.
Thanks, Daniel. Daniel Sherwin-Simpson there from the Weather Bureau. So let's look at the western inland parts of New South Wales for tomorrow. The upper western looking at a sunny morning with a chance of a thunderstorm in the northeast in the afternoon. Winds will be south-southwesterlies, 15 to 25 k's an hour, becoming light in the evening. Overnight temperatures falling between 15 and 19 degrees with daytime temperatures reaching the low to high 30s. In the lower western district, sunny with southerly winds, 15 to 25 k's an hour, becoming light in the evening. Overnight between 11 and 15 during the day, reaching the low 30s. It is 12:30.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Great to have your company today on the Country Hour. Now, good news is the Cooper Creek Ferry is up and running for livestock transport and in the coming days for the wider public. Some more details on how that works and what those transporters will be paying very shortly. And the problem of what to do with an excess of eggs.
Now, it's the other way. It's the extreme of the other way for the farmers. You know, like they've got stock they can't sell, so then they discount. And then, of course, it's causing instability and, you know, farmers, you know, can't make a living.
Yeah, we couldn't get them for love nor money not that hot minute ago. And now some producers are saying we've got too many of them. More than that to come as well. Getting a few texts through today. Keep them coming. The text line is 0467 922 783. I'll come back to what I can. We've got to get to news headlines with Matt Coleman first. Good afternoon, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, the South Australian Parole Administrative Review Commissioner will start hearing submissions in December as to why Snowtown killer James Vlasakis should not be released on parole. Commissioner Michael David today decided that the private hearing would be closed to the media. In August, the Parole Board announced its decision to release Vlasakis on parole, with him having served 26 years of his sentence. An Adelaide-based cricket club has banned wangers in its junior program in response to a teenage cricketer's death in Melbourne. The Goodwood Cricket Club has banned underage players and those bowling to them from using the ball throwers. 17-year-old Ben Austin died just days after being injured while practicing. And the Premier says police are chasing every lead in the search for missing 4-year-old boy Gus. Police have returned for a third time to the rural Mid-North station where he was last seen to drain and search a dam. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. Well, months after it's been cut off by floodwaters, the community around Cooper Creek finally has a ferry service up and running. The expectation is that it would be open from today, officially for livestock transporters, with the rest of the community and the wider public able to make bookings from next week. Well, Transport Department Road Maintenance Director Mick Lorenz told me that was all on track.
Yes, so it's a great day for the community along the Birdsville track. As you know, the track's been closed since late June from flooding on the Cooper Creek, but we have been successfully trialling trips across the barge now, across the creek with the barge, and everything looks good to have a opening to the general public on the 5th.
Now, in the meantime, those cattle producers in that area able to utilise those ferry services now?
Yes, so as part of the training and the testing of the ferry, we've had a number of loads that have gone across already, and subject to final official sign-off for the ferry today, it'll be operating for heavy vehicles from today on our normal booking system.
What kind of interest and, demand are you seeing already, particularly from the cattle side of things?
The whole community along the Bursville track very excited to see this happen. We've had a lot of interest from the cattle from the pastoralists to move cattle down through the track. We've got a lot of pre-bookings already from them from slots that they want to use to start moving that cattle to market.
What kind of work has gone to get it here? I know that this has been long awaited by the community. People have wanted in place there for some while. What has it taken to get to this point to have things ready to roll out?
Look, it's a really significant project. The work that's gone into it it's something we've never done before. It's a really quite a complex task when you break it down to all the components of it. We've had an amazing partner in Maritime Constructions who've done the design for us. They've done the construction works and they will actually be operating the barge. The works that have involved getting pontoons from the northwest of WA, reconfiguring those, fitting them out for operating as a barge. That includes putting winches on there, building ramps, putting handrails on the barge. There's a whole series of works that are required to bring this all together.
Now let's talk a bit about the capacity for it, because obviously a fully laden cattle truck is quite a hefty weight. How much weight and volume can it take, and is it up to the task of something of that magnitude?
Yes, absolutely. So our design vehicle for it is a fully laden A-double cattle truck. So it's about 92 tonnes or something of that order. We have run those test vehicles over the barge already, and they look very, very positive. So it's handled it with absolute ease.
And there is a booking and fee structure for use of this going forward, now particularly for those livestock users. Have those fees been determined and settled now?
Yes, they have. So it'll be a fee of $375 per trailer per direction. And that's something that we've negotiated with pastoralists along the corridor.
The infrastructure that's there, when that is not needed any longer, when those floodwaters recede, what's the plan around that then?
Louis, these are very modular, so it's like a series of big Lego blocks that you can take apart and transport, and we can reuse them, reconfigure them in other ways for other projects, but effectively they will be transported down to our yard at Morgan, where we have all our ferry operations. And it may well be that we can reconfigure it for some work in a marine environment or use it for other purposes on the River Murray. But equally, it'll be there ready for the next event. And people who've been involved in that part of the area in the past events know that because the whole catchment is wet, the water can come down that catchment very, very quickly if there's a secondary rain event. And in the last couple of events, we've had that secondary rain event requiring what was the old punt to be to put back into service. So we'll be watching the river very carefully to see if we get that rain in the catchment. And if we do, we'll leave the barge on site and put it back into service for that period.
If you do take it off site, you know, we're talking maybe years down the track and there is another flooding event, how quickly do you anticipate you could have this whole system set up again? Will this be a much quicker process for that community next time around?
Absolutely. The design of it is already been done. All the components are there. It's really just now. If there was a secondary event, it would be assembling it and putting it back into the water. If we look like we're going to get more water down in 2026, we'll leave it on site, we'll leave it established, and it could just wait there for the water to come.
That is the Road Maintenance Director with the Transport Department, Mick Lorenz, there talking about the Cooper Creek Ferry starting today for livestock producers, and then the rest of the public will be able to book and utilise it from later next week. Well, Gillian Fennell is the Chair of Livestock SA, and she told me the ferry opening was a big win for producers and for the community and supply chain.
I think this is an amazing outcome for the pastoral community, because it's not just since I've been the Chair of Livestock SA, and it's not just since Livestock SA has been in existence. The pastoralists in the affected area of South Australia have been asking for a better way to cross the Cooper in flood for, I don't know, 100 years maybe. So this is an excellent outcome for the pastoral community in that area of the state.
As you say, long awaited, it's finally here. In the future, does this give now some greater certainty that there is a plan in place that when these floodwaters come on, people won't be looking at months being cut off, worrying about their livestock, when they're going to be able to move them, maybe not being able to move them at the best time of year, that there will be a much quicker solution now to be able to keep them moving?
Yeah, it's going to make management of your particular pastoral station up in that area a lot more flexible and easier. And now you can respond better to seasonal conditions or price changes. So for those businesses that are operating up there, it is going to make the management of their business much, much easier and more sustainable. So that is a really great thing. And for the guys down the supply chain, you know, the abattoirs, the butchers, the supermarkets, all those sorts of things, they're going to have access to a greater supply of cattle throughout the year, regardless of the Cooper is in flood or not, because there are a lot of cattle up there and they play a very important part of the supply chain. So it's a win not just for the pastoralists, it's a win for the downstream supply chain, it's a win for the consumer, and it's a win for the red meat industry of Australia, actually, to make sure that livestock can move when and where they need to.
Now, I have heard some mixed feedback about the fact that there is a fee involved for that transport for that livestock. Just speaking to the department, they tell me that they've settled on $375 as a fee per trailer. What's your understanding of the thoughts around the fact that there is a fee and whether the fees are reasonable?
Well, when we were initially discussing this project, there was always the likelihood of there being a fee for operation. And as much as I would love to see it free for the locals and for the people who are trying to run a business up there, unfortunately, that's just not possible in this day and age at this particular moment. Maybe if, the government gets a really big windfall or something, they might be able to make fees less for everybody everywhere. But it's, I think it's reasonable, obviously on behalf of producers, I'd like to see it as a zero fee, but let's be realistic about this. I think it's probably about as generous as we're going to get.
And has that come as a surprise? I mean, there was warning, there was some discussions around with livestock operators, with the industry around the fees?
Yeah, there has been ever since the project was first floated. Livestock SA wasn't part of the face-to-face consultation that DIT did with the producers up the track, but that there would be a fee has always been in the mix of discussions that have been being had.
Jillian, while I've got you, this week we've had the federal government flag, well, they have been flagging for some time. They have now introduced into Parliament some proposed changes to environmental and biodiversity laws. There's a lot in it, obviously, and the devil's always in the detail. But, initially in seeing what the government here is proposing, what are your initial thoughts, and do you have any thoughts and concerns, particularly around what these changes might mean for farmers, for producers?
The entire agricultural community of Australia actually is very, very anxious about this new amendment being added into Parliament. We have been watching this very closely for quite some time. The fact that Murray Watt is in charge of it doesn't fill us with confidence after what happened with the live sheep exports. And so we are very, what's a very diplomatic way to say it? We're not certain that our concerns will be even received, let alone taken seriously. And there are quite a lot of concerns. And I know there's probably an element out there that will want to paint agriculture and farmers as, anti-environmentalists and we just want to do whatever we want to do. But that's not actually the case. We want to make sure that everyone gets fairly looked after in any new legislation that's proposed, and that it's not just an opportunity for the government to run roughshod over people in their communities who might have legitimate objections and concerns to, propose new mines or propose projects that involve clearing a lot of land, because it's not just agriculture that is involved in land clearing.
Looking at some of the comments from the National Farmers Federation, their thoughts, well, their comments are around wanting a balance to ensuring that there is environmental protection, but when it comes to ag production, that it doesn't create an imbalance or, you know, negatively impact the productivity of the agricultural sector and increase red tape. Would you say that's a fair call, a fair way to describe it?
Yeah, definitely would be. Red and green tape are two things that are very restrictive, especially in South Australia. We operate in a very highly regulated environment in South Australia when it comes to agriculture. And it is a big concern that any sort of federal legislation will then overlay what we already operate under in South Australia. So having our producers and our members having to meet this added burden when we don't even know what it might be, you know, is a big concern, because we're busy doing our job. We're busy trying to make food and fibre for the nation. And, you know, to have to comply with something that, you know, we haven't even been adequately consulted on it's a big worry. It is a big worry.
That is the Chair of Livestock SA, Gillian Fennell, speaking to me earlier. As I mentioned, the Federal Environment Minister, Murray Watt, yesterday introduced into Parliament some reforms to the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act, saying that the current laws are flawed and need fixing. Here's a little of Minister Watt's address to the press club about that yesterday.
Now, there's a reason why the suite of legislation we introduced in the House of Reps this morning is called the Environment Protection Reform Bills. Because our national environmental law must protect our environment. And when this bill is passed, it will, with several demonstrable gains for nature. First, the reforms will create a new ministerial power to make national environmental standards, which will be regulations under the Act. These standards were the centrepiece of the Samuel Review, and the need for standards is broadly supported by stakeholders. Standards will set the boundaries for decisions to ensure they deliver improved environmental outcomes. Importantly, they will also provide certainty and guidance for business by setting clear and enforceable expectations and uplifting the quality and consistency of decision making. Until the power to create the standards is in the law and we pass the laws, we're unable to make them. But we have started work on them, knowing that people want to see the direction of travel. In the next few days, we'll release draft versions of the first two standards for consultation regarding matters of national environmental significance and environmental offsets.
That's Environment Minister Murray Watt addressing the press club yesterday about his proposed changes to the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act. There's a bit in there, as you say, they've only just been tabled in Parliament, so we'll talk more about these reforms in the weeks to come and some of the more nitty-gritty about what is, in fact, being proposed. A couple of more texts that have come through in regards to the movement of oysters from Franklin Harbour to Haslam near Streaky Bay. This one says, in regards to the transfer of those oysters, will the transfer of those oysters be for sale? For example, biosecurity is a sham, says this texter. So what's stopping cow oysters from going to sale for human consumption? And they've been moved to via Haslam, asks our texter. This one is signed from Jason in Smoky Bay. He says there's 25 mils of dirty water in each oyster. Times that by each oyster, he says that's a lot of dirty water. It is just going on 12 minutes to one.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're with Selena Green on this Friday edition of the Country Hour. Now, what is the supply of eggs like at your local supermarket? Remember, well, some months back, I feel like you could barely get your hands on them. Well, some South Australian egg farmers say they've gone from having high demand to having an oversupply. Back in 2024, about 10% of Australia's egg-laying flock died or were killed in bird flu outbreaks, which led to empty shelves and purchase limits at supermarkets. The egg industry warned those shortages could last until 2028, but Darren Letton from Glenview Poultry Farm in the Riverland says he's sending pallets to Adelaide amid an influx of cheaper eggs flooding in from the east coast.
Yeah, it's not just me. I think a lot of the farms in South Australia are experiencing, you know, we've gone from having that undersupply and you know, everyone's being able to sell their eggs to now we're seeing eggs being flooded in from the eastern states. They've obviously recovered from bird flu and stocked up and probably overstocked up, thinking this is good. And now suddenly they can't sell their eggs. So what do? They dump them into South Australia. So, yeah, it affects probably the guys more so in the city, the egg farmers down in the Adelaide area. But obviously it flows on too, because we're seeing like the bigger supermarkets being flushed with eggs as well. You know, they've got big suppliers that supply nationally, and, you know, and even this overflow effect probably affects them as well. So, yeah, it kind of ripples through.
And it seems surprising because, yeah, obviously not long ago there was, you know, one egg carton per customer. I've heard people talk about some supermarkets had chocolate bars in the egg section, and there was talk that there could be a shortage up until 2028, but now you're saying it's sort of flooded.
Yeah, the industry recovered pretty well. I mean, I guess they were hoping that everyone was hoping there wouldn't be any more bird flu outbreaks, and that was what, you know, almost seemed like it was just lasting forever. I mean, and like sometimes it's probably good for the farmers that they can actually make a dollar, and I mean, maybe the supermarkets also take advantage of that as well. But look, you know, at the other, now it's the other way. It's the extreme of the other way for the farmers. You know, like they've got stock they can't sell, so then they discount, and then of course it's causing instability, and you know, farmers, you know, can't make a living if they're giving away product at cheap prices. So it can cause you to like go broke as well.
And yeah, so how's this affecting you with your own eggs at the moment in terms of getting your product actually sold and what you're charging for them?
Yeah, oh look, we're probably running specials just to try and move them, and that doesn't always work either. So I'm lucky that I've got another farmer in Adelaide that can take them. You know, like I get what I get given, I guess, so it's better than nothing. So you look at the average price you're getting and you're still probably making some money, but it's still frustrating, you know, when you had like kind of the same amount of eggs and you could just sell them easily, and now you can't, you know, because you are competing. And that's just business, I guess. There's always going to be somebody who'll want to do it cheaper than you.
How much extra eggs are you having to find homes for?
Probably I'm selling about 4 pallets of eggs to Adelaide, which would be about 4,000 dozen that I've got a surplus. And, you know, going back about 8 weeks, that would have all just been gobbled up everywhere, you know. So it's one of those things. And I'm not the only one too. Like I said, I've got other farmer friends in Adelaide they're competing against. You know, I heard there were 3 semi-loads of eggs coming in from Victoria. I mean, and that's a huge amount. That's probably like, oh, God, 60 pallets probably, or more of eggs, probably more like 90 pallets of eggs.
That's Aaron Letton there from Glenview Poultry Farm speaking with Eliza Burlage. Well, Catriona Byrne is co-founder of Feather and Peck at Wollunga, and she says she's gone from double her normal orders to about a quarter of normal demand, and she says she's competing with cartons sold below cost.
We still have high demand, but there's a lot more eggs out there now. So we're certainly finding there's a lot of eggs in the market and a lot of in the retail space. We deal mainly in the retail space, cheaper eggs. And I think what's interesting about eggs is that eggs are a commodity for food manufacturing and that end right through to retail. So you're really serving a lot of different customers. And when there's an oversupply, there's price pressure, price downward pressure. And, you know, you'll have your food manufacturers being able to get eggs much cheaper than normally. And then that pushes those sort of eggs into the retail market. So it really does shake things up a lot. Yeah. So we're certainly competing with lots of pallets of eggs in supermarkets and really sharp pricing. In fact, I would say almost below cost pricing in some cases. I don't know for sure, but that would be my guess at it.
Do you think consumers are choosing to buy cheaper eggs potentially from the East Coast now that they've got that supply back?
I think you'll always have consumers. So consumers who choose on price, you know, of course they're going to go for a cheaper egg, and cost of living also puts that pressure on. Some consumers aren't really bothered about where their eggs come from, whether they're South Australian, whether they're what state or how far they've travelled. You've got where maybe 6 months ago everyone was short and people were trying to get egg powder from everywhere, manufacturers were, and people were choosing, they didn't have a choice of egg, they just had to buy whatever egg was on the shelf, whereas now there is a choice. And so what's, I think, a really important message for consumers is if you care where your food comes from and you care about farming and Australian produce and local produce, then it's good to just check the carton and see where it's from and what the density is and how they're farmed. and make those choices, not just on price. I mean, you can bet that lower price eggs are going to be produced in a lower way. So your hen's more confined. It's going to have probably a high soy feed because that's a cheap protein, all of those things. That's a fairly well-known thing in industry. But again, consumers need choice. So, you know, there's plenty of choice out there with eggs at the moment. That's for sure.
Yeah. So do you have like a lot of excess eggs at the moment? And if so, what are you doing with those?
Yeah, we do. We're a much smaller producer than, say, you know, we're probably less than 2% of Australia's eggs. You know, that sort of, we're quite a small, big, and intentionally so, because we hens are all part of a farming system. So our farmers are also producing cattle and beef and flowers and whatever. So much smaller. So we do have more eggs than are on order at the moment. We've sort of gone from maybe 6 to 9 months ago, we had double the demand for what we could supply. And now we probably, I would say, you know, a quarter over what's ordered. So, you know, we do end up with eggs in the chiller. There's a couple of things. I mean, you do sometimes, you can find places like food manufacturers who'll do a good deal on a pallet and push them that way. We've certainly, with our customers, offered good deals. You know, when eggs are in abundance, we really like to keep our valued customers happy and happy to offer discounts to them. It's interesting, we're not set up for it yet, but there's certainly a growing demand for liquid egg, which is pasteurised egg. So it's treated, so it's food safe from salmonella, and that goes through a system. You can do, you've probably seen egg whites or egg yolks in a sort of milk carton looking thing that's on the retail shelves, but they also do them in bladders, like a wine bladder. They're really interesting because you can freeze them. They have a 2-year shelf life. So that's a really interesting thing for egg producers to contemplate, because you can, you know, you're not wasting eggs. You're actually putting them into something that can be used, you know, for aged care, for cruise ships, for bakeries and whatever, who just want egg. They don't want to crack all those eggs. So it's sort of interesting what an excess, you've got to crack the egg pun, excess in egg, does. It makes you think about how else you can use them and extend the shelf life.
Catriona Byrne there, co-founder of Feather and Peck at Wollonga, speaking with Jackson Byrne, and we'll forgive the pun there. But yeah, certainly really some interesting out-of-the-box thinking there around what to do with the oversupply of eggs. But who thought we'd be here this quickly, given, well, major struggles trying to get eggs at the supermarket for a long time there. Then I did notice some on special maybe a month or so ago, and thought, well, that's interesting. That's a turnaround. Now, a Coles spokesperson says the business has worked hard to prioritise local sourcing, recently doubling the shelf space for their 8 South Australian egg brands while offering 2 East Coast brands. And when we reached out to Woolies, their spokesperson said close to 95% of their eggs sold in South Australia were sourced from within the state, and they had offered better value across some of their home brand eggs due to the supply recovery. And we have reached out to Australian Eggs for comment as well.
This week on Landline, the shocking toll of rural crime.
The whole house was destroyed in the fire. The roof collapsed. All that left was walls and some rubble.
That's Landline, Sunday, 12:30 on ABC TV and iView.
You're with Selena Green for the Country Hour, but not for much longer. It's coming up to 1 o'clock. There's probably just enough time for me to remind you that if you haven't voted for your favourite harvest songs in the 2025 edition of the Harvest 100, you've got until the end of today to get your votes in. It does close today, the 31st of October. I just hopped on the website and, yeah, I could still make a submission. So nominations are open. It's now in its fourth year. It's an open invitation to grain producers and those in the industry to nominate the songs that get you through the long days and late nights of harvest. The final playlist is going to be published on Grain Producers South Australia's Spotify account, and the songs will be ranked on the number of times they are nominated. So it's always a bit of fun, and we look forward to finding out once those nominations all closed and the counting has been done to find out what songs you pick, and maybe we'll try and play as many of them as we can on the Country Hour in the weeks ahead as well. So head to harvest100.com.au to submit your top song choices. But as I said, you've got till the end of today. That's it for me for today and for all this week. You can catch up on anything you've missed on the Country Hour on the ABC Listen app, or just search for South Australian Country Hour in your web browser and you'll find all of our episodes there. And don't forget, if you're wanting some reading material for the weekend ahead, ABC Rural, there's some great stories on there, including a story on that blockade. It has them on sparked by that movement of oysters, and Leah McLennan's great exclusive on the court case being faced by Anna Creek Station here in South Australia, allegations before the court that it had built a number of illegal dams. So go and read that one if you haven't already. Thanks for your company today. Thanks for all your texts. Have a safe and happy afternoon. Catch you next week.
News, sport and talk ad-free. ABC Local Radio. Download the ABC Listen app and listen wherever you are.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.